pursuits over the health and well-being of private individuals. But it is also true that each agency has deep wells of scientific knowledge and expertise, dedicated specialists who toil as mostly anonymous public servants with no industry affiliation. I've talked with several myself over the years, including during the writing of this book, and have found many good people, talented and honest soldiers hoping to use their skills to serve the public good. But I have also found time, and again, that many fear speaking on the record, being quoted by name, regarding the work they are doing. They are proud of their research, but they also know that if their findings don't dovetail with powerful corporate interests, there can be hell to pay. They say research findings are sometimes suppressed, censored, and altered, if not perceived as industry-friendly. It often boils down to a simple calculation. As one senior government scientist who was worried about glyphosate but fearful of talking publicly told me, I need to keep my paycheck. One former EPA research scientist, retired now for over a decade, has no hesitation in expressing his view. These pesticide companies, they claim they are helping to feed the world. That is a bunch of garbage, said Raymond Seidler, a microbiologist and retired senior scientist and former team leader for the EPA's biosafety program. They are just helping themselves sell more products, and those products are deadly. Glyphosate should be banned entirely, but the industry has brainwashed folks in key decision-making positions in Washington. That's the way the system works. Seidler says the fact that regulators rely on the chemical companies to run the safety testing of their own products is a fundamental problem, but one that is deeply ingrained in the system. Everybody knows that is not right. Industry should not be running the tests, he said. Seidler, who has been listed by the International Biographical Center of Cambridge, England, as one of the 2,000 outstanding world scientists of the 20th century, and who was a recipient of the EPA's Bronze Medal for Research Service, says research indicating that glyphosate is an endocrine disruptor warrants strong and independent regulatory oversight. It angers him that the agency where he spent 17 years doesn't do more to protect people, particularly children. A look inside these regulatory bodies showed decades of internal struggles to balance the interests of the public with those of powerful corporations that pressure agencies to protect profitable products such as glyphosate. This dynamic is seen in the handling of issues ranging from formaldehyde to arsenic and clean air to climate change. If and when the EPA does move to ban a chemical from the market, it's often only after long, drawn-out battles with environmental and public health organizations and overwhelming scientific evidence of harm. Dow's battle to keep chlorpyrifos on the market despite evidence of detrimental effects on brain development in babies and young children is but one example. Insiders say that when millions or billions of dollars are at stake, political winds blow hard and sometimes public safety is sacrificed. Key pressure comes from members of Congress, who are recipients of the often lucrative campaign donations doled out by industry and who control the budgets for these agencies. Elected officials not only control the purse strings, but also can interfere through legislation or investigations. And, of course, the agencies themselves are run by political appointees who answer to the White House. It all adds up to a system of oversight that is often ineffectual, overwhelmed, and corrupt. Attempts have been made to divorce politics from the regulation of toxic chemicals. When President Barack Obama took office in 2009, he pledged as much, promising in his inaugural address to restore science to its rightful place, and citing the need for a more watchful eye over market forces. Obama's appointee as EPA administrator, a chemical engineer named Lisa Jackson, made the commitment directly to EPA employees after taking the reins. The president believes that when EPA addresses scientific issues, it should rely on the expert judgment of the agency's career scientists and independent advisors. When scientific judgments are suppressed, misrepresented, or distorted by political agendas, Americans can lose faith in their government to provide strong public health and environmental protection. Jackson wrote in a January 2009 internal EPA memo to employees. Jackson, whose career included 16 years as an EPA staffer prior to her appointment, singled out regulation of chemicals as one of many areas in need of reform. It is clear that we are not doing an adequate job of assessing and managing the risks of chemicals in consumer products, the workplace, and the environment. It is now time to revise and strengthen EPA's chemicals management and risk assessment programs, she wrote in that memo. Under Obama, the EPA, the USDA, and other agencies were ordered to establish policies to protect scientific integrity and outlaw politically driven manipulation. The moves were badly needed, particularly at the EPA, after political interference during prior administrations derailed many determinations of dangers posed by toxic chemicals. A probe by the U.S. Government Accountability Office, GAO, found that the George W. Bush administration was involved in delaying EPA efforts to assess the public health risks of several chemicals, forcing EPA scientists to give drafts of scientific assessment to the White House's Office of Management and Budget, OMB, for review before they could be finalized. It was a requirement that ensured many such assessments never were completed. In fact, the OMB worked actively to kill several chemical assessments, the watchdog agency's investigation found. Making matters worse, the OMB's review of the EPA's scientific findings were dubbed secret, not to be shared with those most impacted, the public. The GAO found undue political pressure was contaminating an EPA program called IRIS, Integrated Risk Information System, which catalogs scientific assessments and helps the EPA determine safe levels of chemical exposures. IRIS is an important source of information on health effects that may result from exposure to chemicals in the environment, the GAO wrote in its report. Investigators determined that though EPA scientists completed 32 draft assessments for chemical risks from 2006 to 2007, because of political interference, only 4 were actually able to move forward and be finalized in the IRIS system. At the time of its report, in 2008, the GAO found that the 540 assessments that were completed in IRIS were rapidly becoming outdated, even as the EPA needed to be analyzing hundreds of other chemicals. The EPA's IRIS assessment of how much glyphosate is safe for people to consume in food and water on a daily basis, for instance, was last revised in January 1987. The work was based on data provided by Monsanto. The revelations contained within the GAO's audit echoed the complaints of consumer and environmental advocates who had spent years watching the political pressure build and begging for someone to stop it. The Union of Concerned Scientists, UCS, summed up the situation this way. EPA scientists apply their expertise to protect the public from air and water pollution, clean up hazardous waste, and study emerging threats such as global warming. Because each year brings new and potentially toxic chemicals into our homes and workplaces, because air pollution still threatens our public health, and because environmental challenges are becoming more complex and global, a strong and capable EPA is more important than ever. Yet challenges from industry lobbyists and some political leaders to the agency's decisions have too often led to the suppression and distortion of the scientific findings underlying those decisions, to the detriment of both science and the health of our nation. The UCS, a nonprofit founded in 1969 by scientists and students at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, had more than the GAO audit to support its concerns. 1 month after the GAO issued its report, in March 2008, the UCS unveiled a devastating indictment of just how far the integrity of government scientists had fallen. The nonprofit surveyed 3,400 scientists at the EPA, the FDA, and several other agencies about their levels of independence. The group found 1,301 scientists who said they feared retaliation if they expressed concerns about mission-driven work. 688 scientists who reported they were unable to publish their work in peer-reviewed journals if it didn't adhere to agency policies, and 889 EPA scientists who had personally experienced inappropriate interference in their work. Nearly 400 scientists said they had witnessed EPA officials misrepresenting scientific findings. 284 said they had seen the selective or incomplete use of data to justify a specific regulatory outcome. And 224 scientists said they had been directed to inappropriately exclude or alter technical information in an EPA document. Nearly 200 of the respondents said they had been in situations in which they or their colleagues actively objected to or resigned from projects because of pressure to change scientific findings. The UCS concluded, political appointees have edited scientific documents, manipulated scientific assessments, and generally sought to undermine the science behind dozens of EPA regulations. The findings of the UCS survey were not much of a surprise. In 2004, David Lewis, a former senior-level research microbiologist with the EPA's Office of Research and Development, had gone before a congressional committee of the U.S. House of Representatives to blow the whistle on what he saw as corruption of the EPA's internal scientific research review process. Lewis, who spent 31 years at the EPA before resigning in 2003, said he had knowledge of situations in which the agency showed a lack of integrity that clearly threatens public health and the environment. He said agency management passed off unreliable scientific data and erroneous conclusions in order to support certain political agendas. EPA obviously has not achieved a reasonable separation between politics and objective science and fostered an open scientific debate, he told members of Congress. All of that was supposed to change under President Obama. And for a while, people such as Washington, D.C. attorney Jeff Ruck actually thought it might. Ruck had experienced firsthand what it felt like to be blackballed for trying to do what he thought was right as a government lawyer for the California legislature. It was 1 week before he was to be married, in December 1986. And part of his job at the time was to write an assessment of a state prison building project. Ruck had all sorts of concerns, primarily because the facility was to be located on ground so contaminated it would ultimately warrant the Superfund designation, reserved for the worst of our country's hazardous waste sites. His bosses wanted no mention of such concerns in his assessment, but he refused to admit them. He was fired. I saw the fragility of professional ethics in public service, he recalled. I also saw many people I thought were friends shrink away from me for fear of being tarred with my brush. Ruck went on to work at the Government Accountability Project, a nonprofit whistleblower protection group that exposed him to many people who had also experienced the political pressures that can come to bear on government scientists and other employees as they try to do their jobs. That insight led Ruck to co-found a nonprofit group called Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility, or PEER, in 1997, to champion the legal rights and integrity of those public employees. One of the group's top priorities is to combat the manipulation of science at public agencies and shield scientists whose research may run counter to money-making corporate interests. An agency like EPA is constantly saying they're fine, their scientific integrity is above reproach, Ruck told me. But the truth is, these agencies don't like inconvenient facts. Ruck was heartened to see Obama's office call for the establishment of scientific integrity policies at the regulatory agencies. The EPA's 14-page scientific integrity document, enacted during the Obama administration, sounded sincere. It called on scientific studies to be communicated to the public, the media, and Congress, uncompromised by political or other interference. EPA managers were expressly prohibited from intimidating or coercing scientists to alter scientific data, findings, or their professional opinions. Similar policies were put in place at the USDA and other agencies. But setting policies and following them are clearly two different things, and by the time Obama's two terms came to a close, Peer was again dealing with a steady stream of calls from government scientists complaining of bureaucratic meddling and censorship. Glyphosate and genetically modified organisms, GMOs, along with the insecticides suspected of causing honeybee die-offs, were all on a list of so-called sensitive subjects that government scientists said they were told they needed to be wary of weighing in on. The integrity policies that were supposed to have been established to protect employees were toothless efforts to paper over problems with no significant impact, Ruck found. Less than a month after the International Agency for Research on Cancer, IARC, linked glyphosate to cancer, Peer filed a legal petition with the USDA demanding that the agency do more to protect its own scientists, who increasingly were raising questions about the safety of farm chemicals, including glyphosate. Several scientists had complained to Peer lawyers that their research was being restricted and they were being subjected to retaliation for attempting to talk publicly about work they were doing that conflicted with agribusiness interests. The scientists were too afraid for their jobs to speak out about their complaints at that time, but in the winter of 2015, one did come forward as a whistleblower. That scientist, an entomologist and agroecologist named Jonathan Lundgren, who had worked for the agency for 11 years, said that USDA managers had blocked publication of his research, barred him from talking to the media, and disrupted operations at the laboratory he oversaw after he tried to point out safety problems with a lucrative class of insecticides known as neonicotinoids that are sold by Bayer, Syngenta, and other big agrochemical companies. Two research reports by Lundgren concluded that farmers received no yield benefit at all in using the high-priced neonicotinoid seed treatments the companies were selling. His research also showed that neonicotinoids exacerbated conditions threatening the disappearing monarch butterfly population. But a supervisor told him the manuscript was sensitive and required elevated levels of approval, Lundgren said. After agonizing for at least 2 years about whether or not to go public with what had happened, Lundgren filed a lawsuit against the agency in late 2015, resigning his post and putting a name and a face to the bigger problem of an agency under political influence. It was a difficult move for Lundgren, who had been considered a top USDA scientist and was named by President Obama as the recipient of a Presidential Early Career Award for Scientists and Engineers in 2011. There is a lot of fear in government scientists, Lundgren reflected. If they don't fall into line, their science is torn apart and their personal lives are discredited. In my case, everyone that I cared about was either directly or indirectly attacked by the chain of command. Rules are selectively enforced to make the rogue scientist out to be a miscreant. Threats of criminal accusations are levied. These scientists are made an example of. After Lundgren left the USDA, he and his wife, Jenna, retreated to a patch of prairie land in rural South Dakota, where Lundgren now conducts his research unfettered by political pressures. A group of area farmers and beekeepers helped him turn an old pole barn into a research facility, and a former dairy parlor where cows once were milked became his office. He spends his time focused on finding solutions for sustainable food systems. Drawing attention to oneself by doing controversial research is a quick way to draw ire and retaliation from the chain of command, he said. But the world is facing some serious challenges right now, and we need science in areas like pollution, climate change, and our broken food production system more than ever. A different USDA scientist, a veteran of the agency who specializes in plant health, has yet to find the courage to come forward with his concerns about glyphosate and the agrochemical industry. His work seems only mildly controversial, and it dovetails with that of others who fear the chemical is having long-term harmful effects on soil health. But because it runs directly counter to the positions of Monsanto and other industry players, he doesn't think he can risk speaking what he sees as the truth. We have some pretty good research, but the USDA doesn't want to look at it, he told me, asking me to keep his identity a secret to protect his job. When it comes to glyphosate, Monsanto clearly has seen the EPA as more ally than independent authority. A 2013 statement by the EPA concluding that glyphosate does not pose a cancer risk to humans has long graced a Monsanto webpage, for instance. The statement, posted in the Federal Register, was made as the EPA agreed to Monsanto's request to permit more glyphosate use on food crops and was based on data submitted by Monsanto. And immediately following IARC's announcement that its scientists had found glyphosate to be a probable human carcinogen, the company's expectation of EPA support was clear. Monsanto's Dan Jenkins, the company's key liaison to the EPA, scrambled to talk with agency officials, including Roland, asking if the EPA would correct the record and emailing the agency 5 pages of information to use in answering questions from the media. The document provided guidance on how to discount the various studies showing links to non-Hodgkin lymphoma, NHL, and the tumors found in mice, and glyphosate detections in blood and urine, and it was shared among EPA staffers. The EPA has also dragged its feet on complying with Freedom of Information Act, FOIA, requests, failing to release thousands of pages of documents dealing with Monsanto and glyphosate. It makes sense for Monsanto to seek to sway the agency in any way it can. After all, the EPA's judgment affects regulation both in the United States and abroad, and it is relied on by many farmers and consumers as the voice of authority on whether or not caution is required in using the chemical or consuming its residues in food and water. Moreover, the agency's assurances about glyphosate's safety give Monsanto an ace card in arguing that the individuals who are suffering from NHL and suing the company are wrong to believe their cancers were caused by Roundup. Exactly how hard Monsanto or its surrogates pressured the EPA over glyphosate is unclear. Monsanto argues there was no improper agenda to push the EPA to issue a positive cancer review for the chemical. But attorneys for the people suffering from NHL say that buried within millions of internal Monsanto documents obtained through discovery is damning evidence demonstrating that the company has enjoyed a tight hold on the EPA for years. Exposing corporate influence is a key part of the legal strategy for those suing Monsanto. But the issue has a much broader significance, of course, because everyone using or consuming the chemical should expect thorough and impartial evaluations by regulators. Though the story may take years to fully unfold, the early court filings in the Roundup litigation are both intriguing and highly concerning. They point not just to a close relationship between Monsanto and the EPA's Jess Roland, but to a culture of regulatory corruption and collusion with the chemical industry. One particularly damning document that has turned up, sent anonymously to lawyers for the cancer victims, is a letter addressed to Roland from a fellow EPA scientist, dated March 4, 2013, that accuses Roland of playing political conniving games with the science to favor pesticide manufacturers such as Monsanto. "It is essentially certain that glyphosate causes cancer," states the letter, which came to light as evidence in the Roundup litigation. "For once, do the right thing and don't make decisions based on how it affects your bonus." The letter to Roland carries the sign-off of 30-year career EPA scientist Marion Copley, who left the agency in 2012 and died from breast cancer in 2014 at the age of 66. The letter accuses Roland of having intimidated staff to change reports to benefit industry, and it says that the scientific evidence surrounding glyphosate clearly shows the chemical should be categorized as a probable human carcinogen, the same classification that IARC would make 2 years later. "I have cancer, and I don't want these serious issues to go unaddressed before I go to my grave," the Copley letter states. Longtime EPA scientist Evangelos Valianatos, a gregarious Greek who grew up on a small farm among olive groves in his home country and still speaks with a heavy Greek accent, said Monsanto has a long history of improper influence inside the EPA. During his 25-year EPA stint from 1979 to 2004, he spent most of his time in the agency's Office of Pesticide Programs, where he saw repeated examples of what he believed to be clearly corrupt practices. It wasn't just Monsanto. The agency was nearly completely beholden to corporate interests, he remembers. It's the pesticide merchants and GMO companies. They are the real decision makers, he said. They use their lobbyists to shape national policy by almost buying politicians. It's this corruption that subverts the EPA. I am not a prophet, but I can see a very dark future if we fail to ban glyphosate and all other neurotoxins and carcinogens in our food and natural world. Belianados now writes and speaks publicly about what he says is a transformation of the EPA from a public watchdog to a polluters protection agency, and he cites numerous specific examples backed by EPA documents to support his claims. He compiled many of his observations in a 2014 book called Poison Spring, The Secret History of Pollution and the EPA. Valianados sees Monsanto's actions to defend glyphosate as similar to the storyline that played out during his time at the EPA over dioxins. The toxic chemical contaminants that were found in the production of Monsanto's Agent Orange herbicide and other pesticides used in the United States and abroad. The EPA now acknowledges that dioxins are highly toxic and can cause cancer, reproductive and developmental problems, and damage to the immune system, and can interfere with hormones. But for many years, the agency aligned with Monsanto's assurances of dioxin safety and relied in part on company-sponsored studies that showed human exposure to dioxin did not translate to increased cancer risks. Just as Monsanto has been trying to do with glyphosate, the company was able to leverage the EPA's inaction on dioxins to defend itself against legal claims. Those studies were suspected to be fraudulent by EPA chemist Kate Jenkins, and her accusations triggered the EPA to launch a criminal investigation of Monsanto. But after 2 years, the investigation was quietly closed with no action against Monsanto. Monsanto ultimately was not able to dodge the dioxin issue, however, agreeing in 2012 to commit more than $90 million for cleanup of dioxin contamination in Nitro, West Virginia, and for medical monitoring of Nitro residents who had been exposed to the company's contaminants. The fear with dioxins was unprecedented toxicity. The strategy with glyphosate is protecting unprecedented profits, said Valianados. Certainly, the EPA's job of overseeing the use of pesticides is not an easy one. As of September 2012, more than 16,000 pesticides were registered for use in the United States. That job is made harder by the fact that the agency's workforce has been in steady decline over the past two decades, dropping from more than 18,000 employees in 1999 to roughly 15,300 in 2016. But still, the agency's scrutiny of pesticides allowed on the market has been deeply flawed. An investigation by the Natural Resources Defense Council, NRDC, found that most of those 16,000 pesticides were approved under what is known as conditional registration, a streamlined process meant to apply only in rare circumstances. Conditional registration allows products to enter the marketplace even though some of the required data may not have been submitted or reviewed by regulators. Chemical companies are supposed to provide all the needed data within certain timeframes, but a review by the GAO determined that the EPA database designed to track these conditional registrations was a failure. The American public may think all pesticides receive rigorous health and safety testing before they hit the shelves for sale, but our investigation shows their trust is misplaced, said the NRDC's Jennifer Sass. The EPA has casually approved more than 10,000 pesticides for use in consumer products and in agriculture. They've done so without transparency or public comment and, in some cases, without toxicity tests to determine safety guidelines for public use. Questionable behavior by top agency officials has been seen time and again, particularly the prioritizing of secrecy over public accountability. Not only does the agency routinely fail to meet legal requirements for complying with FOIA requests to disclose records of its internal business, but top officials have also created alter ego email addresses for conducting agency business, a practice that public interest groups feared was keeping agency work with corporate players away from the prying eyes of the public. Obama's top agency chief, Lisa Jackson, for instance, was caught using an email account with the name Richard Windsor to correspond with other government officials. The Competitive Enterprise Institute, a conservative Washington think tank, sued the Obama administration in 2012 for access to those emails, and Jackson subsequently resigned. The EPA has maintained that there is nothing nefarious about the extra email accounts and that administrators commonly use email addresses separate from those known to the public so they can more easily conduct business. The EPA has said these emails are available through the FOIA, just as the official emails are. Still, an investigation by the Associated Press found that many government officials use these secret email accounts in ways that complicate an agency's legal responsibilities to find and turn over emails in response to congressional or internal investigations, civil lawsuits, or public records requests. The EPA's handling of the new herbicide that Dow brought to market combining 2,4-D with glyphosate also raised eyebrows. An investigation by the Chicago Tribune found that the EPA intentionally downplayed the risks of the new herbicide and ignored a law that required an extra safety factor to protect children's health. The Tribune's Patricia Callahan discovered that EPA and Dow scientists had changed important analyses and a key measurement of toxicity in a pivotal rat study in ways that tweaked risk calculations just enough to allow for a dramatic increase in the use of the weed killer. Because much of the extra herbicide would be used on food crops, the EPA's changes meant that children in the United States could start consuming levels of 2,4-D in combination with glyphosate that the World Health Organization, Russia, Australia, South Korea, Canada, Brazil, and China considered unsafe. It's no secret that money talks in Washington. And it's no secret that Dow, Monsanto, and many others spread a lot of it around. CropLife America, whose stated mission is to promote agricultural pesticides on behalf of its membership of chemical companies, also is a generous donor to the policymakers who influence agricultural and pesticide policies. When it's all added up, many millions of dollars are spent each year on lobbying by the agrochemical companies and their associations. CropLife alone spends more than $2 million per year on lobbying, for instance. The group also shelled out more than $260,000 in political contributions in 2016. And, according to research by the Center for Responsive Politics, agribusiness interests spent more than $127 million on lobbying and donated more than $26.3 million to political campaigns in 2016, including those of several congressmen who are members of the House Agriculture Appropriations Subcommittee. The organization frequently cites protection of farmers' interests when lobbying, but it is clear where its loyalties lie. Its board of directors is composed not of farming groups, but of multinational chemical companies. And in its role as the lobbying arm for the farm pesticide industry, CropLife has immense power in Washington, wielding it to advance policy that highlights the vital role of pesticides. The EPA's acquiescence to CropLife's demands to remove Peter Infante from the scientific advisory panel it convened on glyphosate in December 2016 was but one of many examples of CropLife's power and its efforts to influence the EPA. Top CropLife officials have served on advisory committees for the EPA and provided guidance on such matters of regulatory law as the Food Quality Protection Act, which deals with health-based standards for pesticides used in foods. CropLife has argued that a variety of laws aimed at providing clean water and protecting endangered species are unduly burdensome, as are rules that aim to reduce pesticide drift. CropLife has been a key player in delaying EPA action to remove the dangerous insecticide chlorpyrifos from the market, shrugging off the research showing the risks to children's brain development, and it has been a tireless champion of glyphosate safety, despite the many studies that indicate otherwise. The organization has battled against EPA efforts to use epidemiology studies to analyze the safety of certain chemicals, instead telling the EPA it should continue to rely on industry-funded toxicology research. And it pushed back on EPA efforts to heed scientists' warnings that formulated herbicides, such as Roundup, may be more toxic than are the active ingredients alone. That strong arming came in the summer of 2016, when the EPA said it was developing a research plan with the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences to evaluate the role of glyphosate in product formulations and the differences in formulation toxicity. Considering the growing body of independent science showing that product formulations, like Roundup, could be more dangerous than previously known, more research would seem to be an obvious move for the EPA, but not to CropLife. In a sharply worded letter to the EPA, the association criticized the agency for raising the concern and said that any data needed should come from the companies registering and selling the products. The EPA then quietly backed off the plan. "They want no regulations at all so they can make as much money as possible," said environmental lawyer Charlie Tebbett, who has spent 30 years battling with chemical companies and organizations such as CropLife. He sees the agrochemical industry's substantial power over regulators and lawmakers as business as usual, despite the obvious harm to people and the environment. "The public needs to know what they're doing behind the scenes," he said. There are real concerns that corporate influence could become even more pronounced during Donald Trump's presidency. Many of Trump's picks to oversee federal regulatory agencies have a record of siding with corporations on matters of public policy. Trump's advisors have pushed for large budget and staff cuts at the EPA, and, notably, Trump's pick to run the EPA, former Oklahoma Attorney General Scott Pruitt, has a long history of fighting environmental regulation. As Oklahoma's Attorney General, Pruitt sued the EPA several times over regulations dealing with air quality and pollution. He has primarily championed the interests of the oil and gas companies, which make up one of Oklahoma's most economically powerful industries. But many fear that his affinity for industry will extend to the chemical companies peddling pesticides. Even before Pruitt's nomination was approved by Congress, during the first week of the Trump administration, EPA scientists found themselves effectively gagged, ordered not to talk with the public or the press about their research. The EPA's public social media websites and press releases were frozen, and the communications director for Trump's EPA transition team announced that scientific reports generated by EPA scientists would be reviewed by political appointees before being made public. The actions sparked such a strong public backlash that the administration retreated and said there would be no such mandate. The obvious efforts to suppress science prompted environmental activists to scale a crane located near the White House on Trump's fifth day in office and unfurl a large golden banner that featured black lettering proclaiming the message, "Resist." Fears were realized only a few weeks into the new administration when Trump unveiled a budget plan that would slash the EPA's budget by 31% and cut roughly 3,000 employees from the agency. And the depths of allegiance to corporate interests was underscored when new EPA Chief Pruitt overturned the agency's proposed ban on chlorpyrifos, handing a hard-fought victory to Dow AgroSciences, the chief purveyor of the insecticide. The move stunned and outraged environmental and consumer advocates because it had taken them years to get the EPA to acknowledge the evidence of the harm chlorpyrifos has on children's brain development. But over at the USDA, the move was applauded as a boon for farmers and agribusiness. Critics noted that Dow's parent company, Dow Chemical, had donated $1 million to Trump's inauguration, and shortly after the contribution, Trump chose Dow Chemical's chief executive officer to lead the American Manufacturing Council. If chlorpyrifos gets a pass, it's unlikely that glyphosate or any other highly profitable pesticide will get serious scrutiny by the EPA anytime soon. Such moves by government agencies are unsettling, and the future of scientific independence and integrity is an open question as I write this. Former FDA chief Robert Califf, a cardiologist who left the agency when Trump took the White House, and who himself had been criticized as being too close to the pharmaceutical industry, stressed the need for a clear separation between politics and the work that should be done on behalf of the public. Political appointees should not be interfering, he said. Once that happens for the wrong reason, how do you ever stop politics from dominating this arena? In the view of Dr. Paul Winchester, medical director of the Neonatal Intensive Care Unit at the Franciscan St. Francis Health Network in Indianapolis, Indiana, the EPA and other regulators are endangering generations of children by allowing pesticides such as glyphosate to become so pervasive. Research that he and other medical professionals are pursuing clearly shows correlations between pesticides found commonly in food and rising levels of chronic disease and neurodevelopmental problems in children as they grow into adults. He's outraged at what he sees as the EPA's complicity with corporations such as Monsanto to cover up the dangers of the pesticides they peddle. This is a huge issue. We are convinced there is more than ample science to raise serious concerns over rising herbicide use and exposure, yet not nearly enough is being done to either dismiss such concerns or study them in a meaningful way. People think global warming is the biggest threat, but it's not. This is. Chapter 12. Seeking Solutions. If, having endured much, we have at last asserted our right to know, and if, knowing, we have concluded that we are being asked to take senseless and frightening risks, then we should no longer accept the counsel of those who tell us that we must fill our world with poisonous chemicals. We should look about and see what other course is open to us. Rachel Carson, Silent Spring. For Stephen Ellis, who grows wheat, barley, corn, and soybeans on 4,200 acres along Chesapeake Bay in Virginia, questions about glyphosate's safety and effectiveness are part of a broad risk versus reward ratio that he and other farmers must calculate as they confront the constant challenges Mother Nature brings. Ellis has used glyphosate for decades, and though he has studied the reports of the links to disease, he knows that other herbicides are clearly more dangerous. Like other farmers, he uses paraquat, for instance, despite knowing that a few drops accidentally ingested can kill quickly. The chemical corrodes the gastrointestinal tract and leads to kidney, liver, and respiratory failure within days. Comparatively, the possibility that glyphosate may cause cancer years down the road is a risk he considers worth taking. And Ellis is a businessman who believes that his farm income has benefited greatly from glyphosate. Once Roundup Ready crops came along and he could spray glyphosate directly onto growing corn, he was able to put land that had become overrun with weeds back into viable production. He also counts as a reward the fact that glyphosate use made it possible for him to avoid tilling the ground, which helped control erosion and chemical runoff into the waters of the bay. Before glyphosate resistance became a problem, life was good and easy, Ellis recalled. Now, resistance is such an issue that he, like other farmers, is having to use additional chemicals to fight the weeds, and he is wondering how long glyphosate will last. Still, the chemical was a godsend for many years, he told me. For a lawyer like Charlie Tebbett, who studies the impacts of chemical use on the environment and fights to hold companies and regulators accountable for pesticide problems. The fact that farmers have been big fans of glyphosate and other pesticides, despite their harmful ramifications, is not surprising. The chemical companies are like the drug cartel warlords that get their people addicted to their drugs, he says. They then argue that farmers need their products once they've hooked them. Arguments by companies, such as Monsanto, of altruistic goals to feed the world are almost laughable. Money is the driver, and always has been, as far as Tevet is concerned. The global market for pesticides is valued at roughly $65 billion per year and growing, with the countries that make up the Americas the largest buyers. There is no doubt that many millions of farmers around the world have found rich benefits in glyphosate and other common agrochemicals and have come to believe that those rewards are more than worth the risks. Even if glyphosate were to be banned or sharply restricted, as many people around the world have demanded, substitutes are just as dangerous, if not more so. Whether they are coated on seeds or sprayed from the ground or the air, pesticides have become ubiquitous in agriculture. Many farmers know no other way. Our dependence on chemically based agriculture is an unfortunate truth, but so is the fact that the modern agricultural practices so highly dependent on synthetic pesticides simply are not sustainable over the long term. Not if we want to protect the health of our families and our environment. There is simply too much evidence that pesticides contribute to elevated rates of chronic diseases such as different cancers, diabetes, neurodegenerative disorders that include Parkinson's disease and Alzheimer's disease, and reproductive disorders. Farmers are at higher risk because of their direct and repeated exposure to pesticides such as glyphosate and the many other herbicides, fungicides, and insecticides. But everyone who eats the foods produced with these pesticides is also at risk. And though the chemical agribusiness industry has long contended that low-level exposures pose no risk to human health, numerous scientists and medical professionals no longer are willing to accept that false assurance. Along with the wide use of pesticides in the world, the concerns over their health impacts are rapidly growing. There is a huge body of evidence on the relation between exposure to pesticides and elevated rate of chronic diseases such as different types of cancers, diabetes, neurodegenerative disorders like Parkinson, Alzheimer, and amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, ALS, birth defects, and reproductive disorders. An international team of toxicology experts wrote in a 2013 scientific research paper. The scientists said, there also was circumstantial evidence on the association of pesticide exposure with asthma and chronic obstructive pulmonary disease and autoimmune diseases such as systemic lupus erythematosus and rheumatoid arthritis. The scientists said improved policies for pesticide use were needed. Children are especially susceptible to the adverse effects of pesticides, as demonstrated by epidemiologic evidence of associations between early life exposure to pesticides and pediatric cancers, decreased cognitive function, and behavioral problems. And pesticide-laden diets, the snacks and cereals laced with weed and bug-killing chemicals that so many of our children consume, are a big concern. More than 7 years ago, in May 2010, scientists from the University of Montreal and Harvard University released a study showing that exposure to residues of pesticides commonly found on vegetables and fruit can double a child's risk of attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, ADHD, a condition that leaves kids with problems concentrating, hyperactivity, and impulse control issues. The 60,000-member American Academy of Pediatrics has been calling on regulators to strengthen pesticide oversight and take steps to better protect children, including the advancement of less toxic pesticide alternatives. The doctor's group is but one of numerous organizations representing medical professionals, scientists, consumers, environmentalists, and others who are demanding a healthier path forward. So how do we get there? There are no easy answers, though many experts have ideas about how to start. Even some of the biggest agrochemical companies are beginning to acknowledge that new measures are needed for the future. One partial solution may be found within the soil itself. In areas not ravaged by overuse of pesticides, a handful of soil can hold millions of microbes that carry rich traits to help plants grow better. Different traits interact with plants in different ways, but scientists have started harnessing and reproducing these beneficial microbes with the aim of converting them into commercial crop tools, sprays, coating on seeds, and more, that could help crops resist disease and pests, absorb nutrients more efficiently, and generally improve overall plant health, quality, and yield. Industry leaders say they are working on treatments for corn and beans, wheat, canola, cotton, and many types of fruits and vegetables. Some such biologicals have already been brought to market with mixed but promising results. Many of the early generations of products combine microbials with synthetic pesticides, but the hope of many developers is that eventually the biologicals, which include both biopesticides and biostimulants, can stand on their own, and that these more natural crop treatments can supplant harmful synthetic chemical offerings such as glyphosate. Because these microbial solutions are drawn from naturally occurring bacteria and fungi, they face far fewer consumer concerns and an accelerated path through the regulatory approval process. Even the titans of the pesticide industry have jumped into the race to develop these new crop treatments in recognition, no doubt, of the perilous future the current pesticide treadmill portends. The work started with small research and development firms, but as the potential value emerged, the big agricultural players quickly jumped in, buying up or partnering with the smaller firms. Monsanto tried to outpace competitors by testing more than 2,000 microbial strains at the same time on hundreds of thousands of field plots around the United States, a strategy Monsanto claims gives it the largest microbial research program in the world. The company partnered with a smaller biotech company called Novozymes in its quest to dominate the biologicals market, which analysts project at around $2 billion with a growth rate of 10 to 15% in the next few years. And though the company is careful not to criticize its own history of pushing harmful pesticides into the market, Monsanto's top scientist, Rob Fraley, calls the move badly needed. By working with a plant's own naturally occurring processes, we have the potential to create products that are very precise and specific in how they work and may require smaller and fewer applications than current agricultural products, he said. That's better for farmers, more sustainable and consistent with our vision to create products that enable farmers to produce more and conserve more. Jim Jones, Assistant Administrator for the EPA's Office of Chemical Safety and Pollution Prevention under President Barack Obama, has long been a big fan of the movement toward biologically based crop applications. Jones spent 26 years as an EPA staffer working on chemical safety issues before being named by Obama to oversee the Chemical Safety Office in 2013. So he has deep insider knowledge of the agency's strengths and weaknesses when it comes to protecting the public from pesticides. During a meeting in his office in the hulking EPA headquarters, he told me that the agency wanted to encourage the development of biopesticides because they have very favorable human health and environmental profiles. And he predicted that they were likely to overtake synthetic chemicals in agriculture at some point. The EPA set up an approval system that was pushing the new biopesticides through in less than a year, compared with the 2 to 3 years or more it takes for many synthetic pesticides. The EPA has also offered reduced fees associated with registering biopesticides. We're pretty bullish about them, Jones said. We go out of our way to express our enthusiasm for biopesticides. Jones left the EPA with the transition to Donald Trump's team, but the biopesticide program continues. The EPA defines biopesticides as products derived from natural materials such as animals, plants, bacteria, and certain minerals. The agency believes they are inherently less toxic than conventional pesticides and are safer for the people applying them. They also typically are effective in very small quantities and decompose quickly, reducing exposure and pollution problems. Biopesticides generally affect only the targeted pest and closely related organisms. In contrast to broad spectrum, conventional pesticides that may affect non-target organisms such as birds, insects, and mammals. One example of how biopesticides can help farmers is seen in a naturally occurring single-cell yeast found on Golden Delicious apples and in the tissues of other plants. Scientists determined that this yeast could be isolated and applied to apples and pears after harvest to control particular fungal pathogens. Researchers have also developed products that rely on types of bacteria that attach to and infect or otherwise suppress types of roundworms that can be very damaging to strawberries and other fruit, vegetable, and field crops. In addition, scientists are discovering ways to arm plants to defend themselves against disease-carrying pathogens. Overall, as I write this, the EPA has approved more than 430 biological active ingredients for use in pesticides. Use of these solely for U.S. agriculture is well over 4 million pounds now, compared with 900,000 pounds in 2000. But while biologically based crop treatments may sound like a fast fix, there are several complications. To begin with, microbes that do their jobs well in certain soils and under certain climatic conditions don't necessarily function as hoped for when used in different settings. Living microbes often also need interaction with other specific organisms to function as desired, a dynamic that can complicate transitioning of the microbes into useful products. As well, concerns about toxicity don't completely disappear with microbial products, meaning thorough testing is still needed. Matthew Wallenstein has been studying the complicated interplay of these invisible biological communities for years as a research scientist in the Natural Resource Ecology Laboratory at Colorado State University. Wallenstein, who holds a doctorate in ecology, is focusing his work on organisms that can enhance plant growth by improving nutrient uptake and enhancing soil health. He and two other Colorado State soil microbiologists started a company called Grossentia that sells organic soil supplements to enhance plant growth. We have an opportunity to continue to improve the productivity and efficiency of crop production by taking advantage of what nature has invented, he said. Within a handful of soil, you have a whole tropical rainforest worth of biodiversity, tens of thousands of different species that have evolved an incredible array of traits, and there is a huge potential to tap some of those natural abilities. But, he said, while there is a lot of science in the lab that shows great potential, there are many remaining challenges to get it to work on millions of acres. What truly is needed to reduce pesticides and all the harm they create is a paradigm shift in the way we view food production and incentivize farmers. Rather than making a frenzied push for the cheapest and easiest crops to grow in a production system dependent on an arsenal of chemicals, we must set new priorities that emphasize long-term gains over short-term profits. Some agricultural and policy experts say diverse organic agriculture is the model to pursue because it reduces pesticide use while creating nutritious food in a healthy environment. But converting a conventional farm to a certified organic operation can take years and exact a financial toll on farmers during the transition. The standards are fairly rigorous. Organic farmers must demonstrate that they are protecting natural resources, conserving biodiversity, and using only approved substances on their farms. Consumer demand for organic foods has been rising steadily as consumers become more aware of the dangers of pesticides, pushing U.S. organic food sales to a record high of $43 billion in 2016. Organic products are now available in nearly 20,000 natural food stores in the United States, and nearly 3 out of 4 conventional grocery stores, with sales of organic products amounting to more than 5% of total U.S. food sales, according to recent industry statistics. Certified organic acreage and livestock have been expanding in the United States for many years,